둘의 지난 얘기 같아. 상처는 새살이도.
Je vais te laisser, je dois recevoir mon vaccin Lac des Îles.
Ton vaccin Lac des Îles?
Ben ouais, tu sais comment j'ai hâte d'organiser mon barbecue au chalet avec toute la famille?
Pas bête ça! Moi, je vais demander mon vaccin restaurant. Ça me manque les soirées improvisées avec les amis.
Hey, moi j'y vais. Je pense pas qu'il fonctionne contre les retards, ce vaccin-là.
La vaccination nous rapproche de tous ces moments. Suivez la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prenez rendez-vous à québec.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Jean Couteau, 6835 Rue Saint-Hubert, June 4th to the 8th.
You put your left hand in, you put your left hand out, you put your left hand in, and you shake it all about. You do the vamachara and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. You put your left hand in, you put your left hand out, you put your left hand in.
Presented by Undefined Radio.
Suoni per il popolo.
E se carte.
That's what it's all about.
Jean Couteau.
Spread your wings.
One-stop Caribbean cuisine for the best in Caribbean dishes. Come visit us and enjoy our specialties such as oxtail, jerk chicken, roti, and many more. Ask about our $8 lunch special on any chicken plates from Tuesdays to Fridays, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Also try our famous crispy fried chicken dipped in our special barbecue sauce. You can order online through your preferred restaurant apps or call 514-365-3636 or enjoy a 10% discount on all in-store pickup. This don't apply to promotions. We are located at 334 Saint Jacques in Lachine. Visit us today. One Stop Caribbean Cuisine, Chef X, new location.
Blessing off a flow like a river. Blessing off a flow like a river.
If You've Got Ears is CKUT's experimental, forward-thinking, avant-garde, and most importantly, creative music radio program every Wednesday at noon. The show has been on the air since 2003, presenting you with sounds that you will not hear anywhere else. And so we're asking listeners, of course, if you want to continue to hear this kind of music on the airwaves, to please donate. CQT's funding drive is currently underway. You can, of course, go to our website to make a donation, cqt.ca. You can mail us a check to 3647 University Street in Montreal. You can also phone, and this show is pre-recorded, but there is someone manning the phones. Might even be me in the future. Future me. 514-448-4013. Today we are honored to have on the show two very beloved members of the creative music community in Montreal, Eliza Caution and James Goddard. We asked Eliza to program this 2 hours, and she insisted on having James on for a free-ranging conversation that touches on all things about both of their creative practices, as well as some of James' work as a curator and promoter of live music. So we'll get right into that. Halfway through the interview or the conversation, we'll play a selection from James's project Skin Tone, and the show will end up with a mix of some of Eliza's favorite Montreal music. It's an incredible mix, so I can't wait for you to hear it. Again, make a donation, cqt.ca, or give us a call, 514-448-4013. If you've got ears, you gotta listen. Here's Eliza and James.
It's me, James, 90.3 FM, CKUT, broadcasting live from the from everywhere now, I guess.
Yeah. I'm broadcasting from Ganesadaga currently. I guess you're up in Jojaga right now currently.
Yep, in my basement apartment in the Mile End, holding on against the gentrification.
Right on. So I guess for those of you who don't know or maybe aren't familiar, James is a local musician, performer, promoter, I guess. Is that a bad word? You put on shows.
I put on shows. Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to Backwash actually, and she said something about like promoters being shady, and I'm like, oh yeah, well I guess I'm part of that, but I try not to be shady in my dealings. So arts administrator, I guess, is often the term I go to. Artist, and it's like Hank Hill from the King of the Hill there, you know, like propane accessories. I'm like arts and arts adjacent accessories or whatever.
Right on. Cool. Well, yeah. So Alex gave me this opportunity to talk about some local artists and some people that I consider friends or people that I look up to. And immediately you came to mind because I like to think of us as peers to a degree at this point.
For sure, yeah. I would hope that we consider each other peers.
Yeah. I've been living in Jojaga on and off for the past 8 years. And in the last 4 or 5 years, I really started performing. And one of the first people I actually saw who kind of turned on the light as far as like what experimental music could be and how it could exist as in a live setting was you. And it was a performance you had given at, I believe it was The Plant. And this probably was like the winter of 2016 or early 2017 maybe. And I had run into you at different shows, different noise events, jazz thingies, and then like punk rock shows. And so I was kind of familiar with your character, but we had never spoken or anything. And seeing you perform that night was like a huge deal for me. And I can't really put into words just how much you kind of validated, maybe is the term I'm looking for, the idea of what experimental music could be and the effect that it could have on a live setting. So I just wanted to tell you that, and thank you for all the wonderful performances and the time that we've known each other, and for taking the time to speak to us today.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I'm trying to think, what year did you say it was? I'm just trying to think which performance.
2016 or 2017, I believe.
Huh. I'm trying to
think. I think you were performing with a guitar player, maybe.
Oh, huh. Oh, maybe it was,
I'm trying to think that, I'm thinking that maybe it was a,
a duo with I played in a duo for a while with the local guitarist Alex Pelshat. So it could have been that. But I was also thinking that I played for a while, I had this trio with Joni Sadler, and sometimes this other fellow, Mazi Javidiani, and then sometimes also Amy McDonald, and that was called Public Transit. Maybe it was Public Transit.
Was there a percussionist involved in Public Transit?
Joni would hit the old drums.
Yeah, I think there was some percussion involved, but I was so fixated on what you were doing that everybody else kind of took a back seat to my experience that night.
You're too kind. No, it's funny that you mentioned we're just going freeform. That's cool.
Sure, yeah. Let's freeform this.
It's funny that you mentioned La Plante, because I watched a performance video just the other day of these bands from Newfoundland actually playing at La Plante, and my little heart La Plante is so La Plante has a presence as a place, you know. It looks like La Plante, it feels like La Plante, you're at La Plante. There's always like one roommate who's kind of grumpy going to the kitchen, like in the middle of the show, like cooking ramen, just like, style. And then but then generally the vibe is very, very nice. There's always like little animals running around, like somebody has a cat or somebody has a dog or something. And you know, it's cozy. And you get to just around midnight and whatever's playing, the headline is playing, and the train comes right by, and it shakes the whole building, and you can hear it, and those windows, you just like those windows like are seared into my, and the minute I saw those windows in this performance video of this, I think it was Property or Lo Siento, one of the two punk bands from Newfoundland, and just like literally my eyes welled up, I was just like, oh, La Plante.
Yeah.
Cause that space has been so special and important to my personal artistic development. I think that was the first place I ever played solo in my entire life.
Wow.
So that was in many ways, that's where Skin Tone, which is like my solo stage persona, was born.
Right. Do you remember how many years ago you've been, that was, or how many years you've been using, performing under Skin Tone?
A good question. That's a good question. I moved to Montreal, Jojoge, in 2011, and I did not perform solo for probably the first two or three years. I had a project with, it's funny, it goes full circle, because I had a project that was born out of working with a fellow at the radio, at a radio station in Kingston. And so we had this this experimental duo called Pop Talk, and our whole shtick was actually that we scripted all our dialogue, like all our stage banter was like these little scripted bits that were kind of like absurdist comedy
sort of, or just like really weird, but kind of funny maybe. And then we we didn't script the music. Like we didn't write the music. We just like fully freedammed, and we just like went harsh noise. Like we like just, I played the saxophone. I only had one pedal at the time. Threw an amp, just cranked to 11. Nevin just had his guitar. He had a hollow body. So, you know, you just kind of even look at the amp the wrong way and it starts feeding back. and so we had all these scripted bits, and then we just break into these noise breakdowns. Like the first time we played was at this gallery space in Kingston, and it actually shook the building and the walls so much that all the art started falling off the walls.
That sounds fantastic. That sounds like totally right up my alley as far as a live show scenario is concerned.
Yeah, I don't think necessarily the audience was prepared for for that. And we'd originally wanted to play the whole show with our backs to the audience, but we realized that is too disengaging. It's too it doesn't work. It's nobody likes looking at that. It doesn't work. And but we were trying to like register some kind of anonymity. So we were playing the whole, so we played all our sets in balaclavas actually.
Wow.
And so we'd do these scripted bits and then jump into this like super loud noise breakdowns, and then like stop really hard, do a scripted bit, noise. And anyways, that was Pop Talk. And so I was still doing Pop Talk when I moved to Montreal. Although eventually Nevin left Kingston and moved to Syracuse, New York. So the distance got a bit much, and he got a bit busy with his master's program or whatever. And then I started Public Transit with Joni Sadler and Maziar Javidiani. That was the first lineup of Public Transit. And yeah, we were kind of, people called us Agit Skronk. I like that term. So it's like there was always these political overtones to everything we were doing. For one of our main pieces we did, we literally sampled drones in Palestine. Like it's crazy to think back, because this,
oh no, we're freezing up for a second.
I'll get James too.
No,
you froze a bit there, James.
Okay, no worries.
Just a second. I have an idea, because I have an Ethernet cable.
Yes, very good idea.
I'm just gonna give me 1 second. And
remember where you were in that story.
Drones over Palestine.
Drones over Palestine.
There you go.
Yeah. So Mazzy had pointed out that it's Palestine, and so there's constantly skirmishes with Israel. And so he pointed out this person when this sort of heating up of violent conflict there was happening, was live streaming. And so we watched the live stream, and you can hear the drones overhead, like the drones are going, and so we ended up sampling that a lot of times, and we'd have imagery of Mazzy's a great designer and artist himself, and so he found all these images of like drones and where they came from. And so a lot of Public Transit songs are named after different drones, military drones, and the language around military drones. No, we weren't glorifying. We were trying to be critical. I don't know if it fully came across properly, but we're not into drones. We think that we're anti drones.
Yeah.
and you know, pro-Palestine, and which does not actually mean anti-Israel, you know, yeah, necessarily. Anyhow, so that, and so then I was, did that for a couple years, and then Mazzy moved to Toronto. So Mazzy had played clarinet, and he's Iranian, and like Persian ring drum. There's this drum that is in Persian music that has all these little metal, it's kind of like a large tambourine, and it has all these like little metal rings around the outside. Anyway, it sounds beautiful. So yeah. And anyways, he moved to Toronto. So then Amy McDonald started playing with us on flute and sometimes guitar, or often we'd actually just put a bass guitar on the floor and stamp around it, and it would feedback. So that was a couple of years. And so then, so I guess now we're around 2013, 2014, and that's, I guess, around when I started playing solo and Skin Tone was born. Unfortunately, at the beginning, I did a lot more playing bass with my feet. That was something I really loved. I loved to just put my bass guitar on the ground and just stamp on it with my feet. I took my shoes off, obviously, but then you know what happened? Somebody stole, who can say? I no longer have a bass guitar. It literally just disappeared one day, and then I've never been able to play the bass with my feet again. Because people get weird when you're like, "Can I step on your bass?" They're like, "No, I'll lend you my bass to step on it. Nope, that does not appeal to me. No, I don't want to do that." Which, fair enough.
Yeah, that's interesting that you bring that up, because being a disabled person myself, I'm actually familiar with people who play electric stringed instruments with their feet.
Mm.
So yeah, I don't know. Just as a side note, that's pretty cool.
Mm. I bet they're more artful with it. I just really liked that, like bass, like having the strings kind of loose on the bass, and it gets a good resonance, and then sort of, because I used to tap dance, and so that's what, like, I would use it as a rhythmic thing, and I'd sometimes, even because the metal on the metal strings, I sometimes would actually wear shoes and tap dance on my bass, and that I thought was an interesting sonic, just the metal meeting the metal right on the contacts was,
yeah, I can imagine. So were you incorporating at the start of Skin Tone, were you incorporating the bass, or was this a direct result of the bass going missing that you became strictly kind of a woodwind situation?
Yeah. At the beginning of Skin Tone, for sure, the bass was part of it. I think I played some kind of show with Ash the Hoots, and a friend of mine was living in Ottawa at the time, and he's like, "Oh, I heard from the Ash the Hoots guy, you were stepping on your bass again." And anyway, so yeah, no, it was definitely I think I'd slowly been transitioning out of using the, like, it was definitely part of it at the beginning, and then I stopped using it, and then I started making more money, so I was able to purchase more pedals, and so then I was able to do more with the pedal chain of the saxophone, and so I became a little, and I guess I was, like, for a minute, I was moving into a more ambient-y territory, and then the bass sonics were very percussive and not so conducive. So and also I think, just, you know, sometimes you get old and you're tired of carrying everything down to the gig, with the amp and the bass and the saxophone and the pedal bag and the cable bag and you're like, oh, what? And then the laptop, and then it's like, okay. Enough is enough. I want to carry less things. So, and then I put my bass somewhere, and then whoosh, off it went into the sunset. I hope whoever took it is enjoying it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it certainly didn't hold you back at all.
But yeah, when did you start performing solo as Eliza Caution? I remember, I think the first time I saw you was, the first time I saw you perform live was at this weird office space in St. Henry that was like some sort of anarchist office space.
Could that be Alex's space by any chance?
No, it wasn't. Because it wasn't at Fatale, but it was like around there, and it was like they had this like afternoon concert. I think my coworker at the time, who's in Claiborne, Maria, was part of organizing it.
It's possible. I played. I used to in my first 2 years. I kind of said yes to everything. So.
So when were the first 2 years exactly?
2016, basically. Okay. Is when I started performing. I had joined a punk rock band with Mood called Butcher Baby.
Okay, yeah.
And we had played one show together at the Not Your Babe Fest, and then everybody kind of like moved away and moved in their respective ways. So like you, I was kind of like left without a band, and it was kind of part necessity, part desire to want to play. And one of my early shows, actually, I played with you and Chris at Casa,
mm-hmm.
the three people and the bartender. But that was, I remember that being a really fun show.
That would have been with Nyon.
Yeah, Nyon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Chris owns a bar in Newfoundland now.
Yeah. It's pretty wild.
Yes. The things noise can take you.
Yeah, totally.
But how long had you been playing? Like, cause you, when you started Butcher Baby, you already had been playing guitar, right? For yourself or taking lessons as you were growing up, or how did you get into that?
Yeah, I started playing when I was 11, 12. And because of my disability, like I had guitars in the house and stuff, and I just kind of fumble with them. And then like 14, 15, I started taking piano lessons, and things kind of started to really sink in as far as like, oh, I can do this. I can practice. Even just learning how to practice, I think, for anybody is a process, right? But I think for disabled people, it's like, it takes a bit longer to get to that place where practicing regularly is even possible. But
And did you have resistance? Like how was it starting to take piano and play guitar like as a disabled person? Did you find that there was was it hard to find teachers who were like understanding or willing to like make accommodations, or was that like all just very smooth and easy and people were supportive?
I'd say it was like kind of 50-50.
Okay.
I was lucky in that I met a really great teacher, this guy named Eldwin Albino, who used to be the steel band director in the Christmas parade back in the 80s.
Okay.
He's like a Trinidadian music professor who passed away like just 2 years ago.
Okay.
But he used to come to teach in Gahnawaga. I was going to school in Gahnawaga for high school, and he would come and give me private lessons, and he was extremely empathetic to my situation and very encouraging. I think I grew up around like kids who were just like playing Iron Maiden songs and stuff, and they were really cool. I feel like the most resistance and the most kind of eyebrows I get are from like sound people who haven't really heard me yet.
Mm.
I'm not sure you can relate to on so many levels, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, okay. I'm not gonna call out any individual sound techs on this radio call, but I do remember very clearly this, a situation where I showed up and I like to, like, obviously there's different philosophies about how to mic the saxophone, but the saxophone itself is not, people have the sense that you stick a dynamic mic in the bell of the saxophone and that's making a saxophone. Often that's a compromise that people make, saxophonists make, to the fact that that's sort of where the most air pressure comes out of the saxophone. And so that it's maybe, it seems on certain notes, it seems like a good place to put a microphone to get the diaphragm of the microphone to vibrate. And if you're playing, say you're playing, which would be my dream, if you ever start one, call me up. Say you're playing in a ska band, for example, and there's, you know, like a guitar and a drums all around you. You can't have high gain condenser mics around on the stage because there's, you know, too much sound bouncing around. So you really need to put a dynamic as close to where you're going to get the most pressure. But when you do that, when you put a microphone right into the bell of the saxophone, you're actually cutting off the instrument because the sound of the saxophone doesn't often actually, and especially, well, I mean, it depends on how you play, but to some extent, but it doesn't, it rarely comes out of the bell. The only time the sound is actually coming out of the bell is when you're playing the lowest note on the saxophone, which, and because it sounds a bit, that note, anytime you're at the edge range of an instrument, you know, you're not getting the timbre of the sound is going to be a bit funny, which is cool. You know, like I love playing with that and getting the deep growls and stuff going. But if you're just, you know, trying to play in a more conventional manner, you actually don't spend very much time down around the lowest note of the instrument or the highest note of the instrument, like, because that, you know, the tonal qualities of those notes are going to be a bit fishy because it's at the edge of the range of the instrument. So you generally don't spend a lot of time there. So it's weird that this convention has been to put mics right in the bell, because you then lose a lot of the sound of the higher notes, and you're only really blasting out the lower notes, that where the sound is more coming out of the bell, and then you get this like boomy tone. And so I like to put mics like I could show you because we're on video, but we're on video on the radio, so no, I can't show you, or I can't show the listeners or whatever. But I tend to put a mic sort of high in front of me and then angled down towards sort of my mouth. And so it's kind of like more at the height. And I just remember going in and sitting down, and I'm like, oh, is this the mic I can use? And the sound tech's like, yeah, that's your mic. And, you know, me adjusting the mic, and the sound tech just losing it on me. I already placed that mic. What the heck are you doing? Why are you moving the mic around? I placed it. It was perfect. And I'm like, oh, but it wasn't I think I'm playing this show, and that's not where I want the mic. No, I'm right. Da, da, da. And I'm just like, I don't know why we have to fight about this, but like, that's not where I want the mic for my performance that I'm going to do that you aren't going to do. And this is my instrument. I think I've probably spent more time miking this instrument than you have. Like, can we, anyways, it's back and forth, yelling, da, 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 da. And finally, the sound tech like conceded, and I got to put the mic where I wanted. But it was just so weird because he was like, "That's where the mic goes," and I was like, "Oh no!" But that's not where I want the mic
for my
performance. Like, that's not where it goes. I don't know. And
you're allowed to swear, by the way, James.
I'm allowed.
Yeah.
Okay. The CRTC is not going to.
Not going to be furious. If you say the F word in the context of a sound man, don't hold back.
Okay.
All I'm saying is don't hold back.
Anyways, it was funny. Anyways, that's one of my stories about sound techs that was like the most conflicty, but I managed to win in the end and held my ground and got what I what I wanted to happen. Also, people don't realize they see me show up with a saxophone, and I do spoken word. I involve spoken word as well. Like I'll stop playing the saxophone and talk. So also, if the mic is like way down where people think they want to put the mic and it's the bell, then I have to like bend over and contort myself in order to talk into the mic. And then it's like, okay, well that, yeah, I like it up here better. What's one of your worst sound tech stories?
Nothing actually that bad. It's never gotten to a shouting match, luckily, because I think that probably would have traumatized me. But it's usually just a lot of, it's partially the sound people, I guess, being impatient, and also maybe they're having a bad day, and we all have bad days. And also, I've never been the greatest advocate for myself as far as putting down on paper what my needs are sonically as a performer. And I feel like that's one of the things, the privileges I have of being able to be around CASA and work with you guys and work with Dan and all these different people and the different folks over there, is that I'm becoming more assertive as far as like what I need and don't need, I think, because I think we can probably both relate to this with experimental music. It's almost like it's different than performing songs. It's different. It's not a recital to me. It's almost, and that's one of the things I got from seeing you perform. It's that like, it's this very fragile, almost symbiont like force that's existing in that moment. And I feel like sometimes sound people try and suck the life forms and sterilize those moments to degrees where the artistic expression is compromised sometimes. I can't really think of any direct moment off the top of my head, but
no, I definitely relate to what you're saying there. It's not song one, song two, song three with a, you know, sort of combat, like you're not, yeah, like you, I think you said it very well. It's not a recital. It's you're creating this. You're trying to create in the room this moment, and the needs of that are sometimes not what would necessarily be considered best practice sonically, but they are the needs of that performance in order to get that that to create that atmosphere and to get that that situation to. Yeah. Work.
And this isn't to take anything away from people who are really great sound engineers and sound techs who, this in no way is this to take away from the professionalism of people who work for Taylor Swift or Kanye West or Kiss or these people who do these giant tours where it's a conveyor belt, you know, as far as like order of operations. But I think for the kind of thing we do in the arenas we perform in, well, the arenas, the spaces we perform in, I think it's yeah, I think we should just take up as much space and rearrange the room as much as we can.
Yeah, that, yeah, often, yeah, like I know often I'll jump up, like if I'm playing, say, at CASA, for example, that's a good example. I'll like jump off the stage during the performance, you know, and I'll run around the room and the sound is like, how are people going to hear you? And I'm like, well, I'll have a pedal chain going through the PA, and the saxophone is an instrument that people generally can hear. and then they're like, well, yeah, but it won't be consistent everywhere in the room. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's exactly the point. That's why I run around the room, is because then it changes how people are relating to the sound, because it isn't consistent. And you have to, you know, if it's a packed room, you have to like, wait, look around, or like you have to move to get close to the sound.
For sure.
And I want
different licks sound different in different parts of the room, obviously.
Totally. Yeah. Moving. I mean, yeah. It's funny because we do streaming now at Sala, right? If the viewers don't, I work for Swoney Paralopopolo in my day job, and every 2 weeks we stream out great local music. So go to the SwoneyParalopopolo.org website if you want to check out some cool streams. But that room is really fascinating, empty, Sala Rosa, now that, you know, the shows are happening with no people, because you there's all these weird part, like, it sounds weird all over that room. And it's kind of cool to, like, sometimes, like, hear, like, a loud guitar, and you can play it, and you can get the room to resonate from, like, different spots. So you're in Ganawage right now.
I'm in Ganasadage.
Tage, sorry.
Yeah. I'm in Ganasadage currently.
Is there snow there?
What's that?
There's snow there?
Yeah, it snowed. It's kind of melting right now, but it's starting to get cold, and I think we're gonna start seeing some accumulation soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a strange mild winter here, and I keep being like, I actually really want it to just snow and be winter.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of false starts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I have a couple more questions if you're still into it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to take it back to your early years and what's part of the country you were from. Where did you grow up? And your initial impressions of music at an early age, and how did that translate into you starting to play it? And around what time did you pick up the instrument?
Yeah, that's interesting. I was raised by my mom, and we moved around a bit growing up. My mom's an academic, so we lived in Guelph, Ontario for many years, and then lived in Melbourne, Australia for a bit, and then lived in Edmonton, Alberta for sort of high school. And then I went to university back east in Mount Allison in Sackville, New Brunswick. So, I've gotten to really live a lot of different parts of Canada, which is cool, and I feel very lucky to have had that opportunity. And I started playing music. Like, I guess when I was little, like, my mom, like, did the classic thing and, you know, put me in piano lessons. And so I guess I started playing music when I was, like, 4 or 5, like, just, you know, little piano lessons or whatever. And I was, oh, my, I was not a very diligent practicer of piano. I don't know why I don't think I actually liked playing the piano very much. But I always said I did, but then I like would never want to practice or anything. And then I was like a little kid, so my mom had to like make me practice. Anyway, I don't know. So I did. I had that kind of very unexceptional kind of background with music. And but I feel like I saw Gregory Hines, like the tap dancer, on TV. And I was just transfixed. I just loved it. And then I was obsessed with tap dancing. So I also did like took dance lessons. And I think, and in my mind, tap dancing and jazz music were very linked together. And so, and I think some of this is like I'm mixed race, and my mother is white, and I think that some of my appeal was like, for some reasons at some young age, it really seared into my mind. I saw like Gregory Hines tap dancing to some sort of jazz, and it was like seeing black people on the TV. And so I got it in my head that tap dancing and jazz is what black people did, and I'm black people. So I need to do that or whatever. I don't know. Whatever. I also, you know, they're also great art forms. So I'm allowed to just love the art. I don't have to have like a complicated, but I do think there was some complicated like racial stuff going on. So I was really fascinated. And then, when I started high school, in Australia, high school starts at middle school, so like grade seven or whatever. And so when I started grade seven in Australia, then there was like a high school band. And so I had the opportunity to like pick an instrument. And so I actually really wanted to play the boom, 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 the like big, big upright bass. But I think the people at the school saw, I'm still not a very large person. I think they were like, this small child will not be able to even support the weight of a bass, of an upright bass, or even a cello. We must give them a small instrument for a small little baby child. And so my second choice was the alto, or was the saxophone. And so then they gave me the alto saxophone, and then. I loved the saxophone, and I played that for all through high school and such. And then I went to university and moved to, well, as I said, Sackville, New Brunswick. And this was the early 2000s at that point, like 2005, 2006. And you know, it was an indie rock world out there. I think there was an indie rock world everywhere, maybe, but like, you know, definitely in rural New Brunswick, it was a college town in rural New Brunswick was definitely indie rock. And I didn't play music again till I moved to Kingston. And then I started that Weird Noise project with Nevin, because there was just no space in Sackville for what I was interested, what I would have been interested in doing musically. Like, the music scene that was there was very very indie rock oriented and indie folk, and it was, you know, rural, and so it was very folk oriented, and there, you know, at the time I didn't have the language there was definitely just no space for harsh noise saxophone. No one would have known what to do with it. So I didn't do anything with it. And then, yeah. But then I was lucky to work with this guy at the radio station in Kingston, where I went after university, Nevin, and we put together this noise project. And then, yeah, and then I started playing and performing, and it became a real, really important part of my life and who I am. And Like if ever I'm feeling like I'm just like in a really bad mood and feeling really crabby and like out of it and stuff, and then I'm like, oh yeah, I haven't played saxophone in like a week. Like, oh, okay, it's not a replacement for seeking real mental health support and therapy. And so I'm not trying to say that that people shouldn't get the professional aid that is benefiting them. And I'm not trying to say that like I'm somehow like healed of all my trauma because I play music or whatever, but there is something I find relieving and therapeutic about playing the saxophone. There's always like, yeah, a release. And often if I'm having trouble getting my head right, playing the saxophone often writes it. Fixes my, not doesn't fix my head, but like helps me be.
Yeah, for sure. No, I can so relate to that, because I tend to notice that too when I'm not practicing often, or I'm lackadaisical with my playing, and I let 7 or 8 days go by without playing, I get into this headspace where all my problems are somebody else's fault, and it's my husband's problem and all these other things. And then I realize, oh, I need to calm down and like just play some music and just get centered. And like you said, it's no substitute for, you know, different mental illnesses or traumas or whatever, but it's such a light in life to be able to perform music, and such a therapeutic experience. I just wanted to expand on that question real quick and take it into experimental music real quick. Like, at what point did you were you exposed to experimental music? Were there artists you look up to, or was it part of being into saxophone that led you to that genre, or vice versa, or how did that come about for you?
So that's That's, yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I feel like I'm always had a bit of a, I don't know, I've always been a big listener. Like, I've listened to lots of stuff. I've always been a music fan, and discovering in my teen years community radio like CKUT that we're speaking on now. But in my context, I'm thinking specifically of CJSR out there in Edmonton. Like finding that and finding and just hear it, like, community radio definitely is a big thing that exposed me to lots of different kinds of music. And I think, like, and to find, to be able to, like, tune in and listen to those platforms and hear all the different things that can happen there and are made made possible by community radio, and just like the outer limits of sound. I just, like, I've always liked, like, loved all music, and that sounds so, I've always been engaged by lots of different kinds of music, and then at a certain point, if you listen to lots of music, the conventions of music, I feel like most people who are into experimental music, and maybe this isn't true for everyone, but I feel like most people are really, it comes from just a love of music overall. And then at a certain point you're like, okay, yeah, I get song structure, but now I want to listen to something that's going to surprise me or listen to something that breaks the rules. Cause the music is, I mean, I try not to play it this way, and I try to pretend to put this out of my head, but, you know, there's something fundamentally mathematical and fundamentally structured and regimented about music. It is, you know, if I play X note, then there's, like, a mathematical relationship for you to play, like, the same note or a note that sounds good with it. And then some notes aren't going to sound good with it, and some notes are good. And it just, like, you know, it is what it is. So then I found myself drawn to, like, the weirder outsider sounds towards the end of high school and towards at the beginning of my university years. And then when I started working in community radio, I had an opportunity to, like, have access to the big music libraries, but also had a platform to, like, play and share and a reason to research weirder musics and outsider musics. And also, you know, like, jazz has always had a wing of challenging music or challenging sort of boundaries and boxes that music was put into. That kind of protest and that kind of rebellion has a long history, deeply intertwined into the fabric of jazz music. So definitely that, I think. Thank you.